service. The 27 Club is a production of iHeartRadio and Double Elvis Media. Jimi Hendrix died at the age of 27, and he lived a life where every day was unlike the day before. I can give you 27 reasons why that statement is true. 3 was his magic number, the holy trinity of the power trio, guitar, bass, drums, that he would master briefly with the Jimi Hendrix Experience and again with the Band of Gypsies. 15 would be the number of miles that he'd ride in a stolen truck with Neil Young to get to Woodstock on time when their plane landed at the wrong airport. Another 8 would be the number of hours a jury in Toronto would deliberate in order to decide if the world's greatest guitarist would spend the next decade of his life behind bars. And 1 would be the number of years he'd have left to live after Brian Jones was found dead at the bottom of his swimming pool, all totaling 27. On this, our 7th episode of Season 1, Magic Numbers, Stolen Trucks, A Dead Rolling Stone, and The Always Searching Jimi Hendrix. I'm Jake Brennan, and this is the 27 Club. Neil Young was searching for the helicopter. The helicopter, man, their own personal chopper, the Woodstock Express, the bird that was going to get them from here to there. But where the hell was that bird, man? Neil stood on the small regional airport tarmac, peppered with small chartered jets like the one he had just flown in on. The sun beating down, he raised his flat hand to just above his eyes to provide shade from the glare, his ruffled dress shirt sticking out from the cuff of his jacket. Where the fuck are they? New York? Vermont? Fucking New Hampshire? Damned if he knew. The mescaline he had ingested on the plane was coming alive now, which made everything crystal clear and messed up all at once. Everything felt great, everything did not feel great. Jimi Hendrix stood next to Neil Young, similarly baffled and equally dosed, along with the other passengers from their little plane. Attorney Melvin Belli and Neil's manager, Elliot Roberts. Melvin, whose high-profile clients included Jack Ruby and the Rolling Stones, was clear-headed and unencumbered. He suggested the logical conclusion to their predicament. They had been dropped off at the wrong airport. There was no Woodstock helicopter coming to get them. Woodstock would have to start without them. And they were screwed, sorta. Oh man, Jimmy laughed and looked at Neil. I'm supposed to go on first, just me and my guitar. He let a repressed giggle snort out from his mouth. Neil let a giant belly laugh run free. It was true, Woodstock's producer, Michael Lang, contracted Jimmy to open the 3-day outdoor music festival with a surprise solo acoustic set, and then close it on Sunday night with an electric set. Jimmy was now the highest paid rock star in the world, ergo he was the highest paid performer at Woodstock, much to Lang's chagrin. Lang had to cap larger acts at 15 grand due to a favored nations policy. And Jimmy's hard-as-nails manager, Michael Jeffrey, was having none of it. Jimmy would do it for 50 grand, and you know what else? His name would be listed first on every print and radio ad. His name would be bigger than everyone else's. He'd headline the gig. It was too much. Lang wanted Jimmy, but he couldn't meet Jeffrey at 50 grand. So Lang and Jeffrey came to an agreement that gave Jimmy the most money but didn't break Lang's rules. Jimmy would play 2 sets for 15 grand each, along with another couple grand for expenses. 30-plus grand total. Thing was, Jimmy wasn't going to make the opening set. He didn't even know where he was. His mind was elsewhere, anywhere but upstate New York. All he could think about was the bust in Toronto, the impending trial for heroin and hash possession. It was 4 months away, and that almost made it worse. All this waiting around and obsessing over every last detail. What he could have done differently, what he should have done differently, what could have happened to him, what would happen to him this December when he'd have to stare down years in a Canadian prison. His fate in the hands of strangers. Jimmy must have checked out for a moment, and the mescaline was starting to take hold after all, because when he turned to look at Melvin, the attorney had taken off his shirt and was pouring a can of beer on his chest.
To facilitate the tanning process, the attorney yelled at him from across the tarmac.
Jimmy rubbed his eyes. It must be the heat, must be the drugs. Neil was at the driver's side door of a pickup truck parked in the airport lot. Neil peeked inside, wide-eyed, and then tried the door. It opened. He hollered at Elliot to keep an eye out, and then jumped in the driver's seat and worked his hands beneath the steering wheel. Clanks, clunks, bangs, booms, a spark, a couple of false starts, and the old truck roared to life. Neil knew that soon, very soon, they would be completely twisted, and there was no going back, no time to rest. "Get in," he hollered to the other three. Elliot and Melvin hopped in the cab with Neil, and Jimmy knew that the obvious thing to do, the rational thing, was to jump on the hood of the truck and hold on for dear life. Of course it was. Neil put the truck in first gear and tore out of the airport parking lot with Jimmy's body swinging from side to side on the hood of the truck. Elliot laughed. "Holy Jesus," Jimmy screamed from the hood. "What are these goddamn animals?" And he lay flat on his stomach, his hands dug into the underside of the hood near the windshield, holding on for dear life. The sky began to darken. Huge bats had taken to the skies, diving all around the truck and nearly missing Jimmy with each dramatic swoop. "Man, is this the way to travel," Melvin hollered, and reached for the volume knob on the AM radio. He cranked the tones of the fifth dimensions, working on a groovy thing until the speakers crackled. "You feel good," Jimmy thought. "You fool, wait till you see these goddamn bats. No point in mentioning it. Poor bastard will see them soon enough," Jimmy thought. Hired to open Woodstock on Friday and close it out on Sunday night, and Jimmy never made it for Friday's commitment. Lang panicked and persuaded Richie Havens to perform in his place, and Richie killed it. And Jimmy wasn't exactly sure what time he finally made it to Old Man Yasker's farm, or what day he made it, or how he made it, for that matter. Did he ride in the hood of the truck the whole way there? Everything was running behind schedule. Set times were all screwed up. Bands would take to the stage hours after their originally scheduled performance times. After waiting around in the mud and the rain, drugs had worn off, or maybe the drugs they didn't intend to take had started to kick in. And by the time Jimmy took the stage with Gypsy Sun and Rainbows, his new band he had formed after the experience's breakup, the Monday morning sun would be rising on a decimated Woodstock crowd. Nearly 500,000 people would have already split. Jimmy stepped on the makeshift stage stuck in the middle of the farm's backyard, more than ready to make a scene for whoever would listen. Roz Payne was talking down a kid in the trip tent when she heard it. Fuzzy and phased out, metallic and shrill, familiar yet completely foreign. She heard the first six notes of the national anthem ring out from the stage. It gave her pause. She stopped talking. The sun had just come up over Yasker's dairy farm in Woodstock, New York. Time stood still. Roz had been calmly helping a young boy get through a bad trip. He couldn't have been older than 19. He had no shirt. It was lost forever, swallowed by the mud sometime after the rains came. A sacrifice for the gods of peace and love. His jeans were wet and soiled with dirt, and the sweat from his forehead seemed to jump over to the inside of his glasses, which were all fogged up. He panted, popped his eyes open wide, shook his head, muttered under his breath. He had taken something, but couldn't tell Roz what it was. Perhaps it was some of that brown acid that the festival organizers kept warning the crowd about from the stage.
"Stay away from the brown acid."
Perhaps this kid didn't hear the announcement and took some anyway. He would cry, and then he'd shake with fear, and then he'd calm down and mellow out about it. And then he'd go through the cycle all over again. Roz sat with him, kept talking with him, positive things, riding it out together. He'd get through this bad trip and come out on the other side. He had survived a weekend of heat and rain, surrounded by hundreds of thousands of total strangers, and surely he'd survive this. He would see. He would be fine, just fine. Roz and the kid were one of the many couples inside the trip tent. Kids on bad trips side by side with their bad trip guides. Woodstock producers had hired a team of doctors, nurses, and EMTs to help over the weekend. but a group of citizen volunteers had stepped in to deal with bad trips. Hallucinations, paranoia, anxiety. Instead of drugs to combat drugs, they'd use good old-fashioned human interaction and let the doctors deal with the foot lacerations and the seizures and the asthma attacks. They did this all weekend, 25 freakouts each hour, 25 bad trips each hour. And by Monday morning, the Woodstock site was a filthy ghost town. Only about 40,000 of the original 500,000 festival goers remained. Everyone had gone home to get back to work, back to the real world, back to their families, back to their lives, tuned out, turned off, and dropped back into reality. And the Monday morning stragglers, refusing to give up the dream, walked through the wreckage, brushed their teeth, tents, umbrellas, shoes, and Coke cans all pressed into the muddy earth and left for dead. Spent trash, t-shirts, condoms, watermelons, oranges, bras, mattress pads, maxi pads, cigarette butts. A skeleton crew served up hot breakfast for those who weren't passed out on the hoods of sedans, for those who weren't nodding off on the ground or unknowingly copping a serious dangerous tan atop a blanket on a sodden expanse of farmland. Roz was there to help. She showed up early, before the music even began, helped set up. She loosened up fencing each day to allow those without tickets to enter the festival grounds. And she was tight with Abby Hoffman and the Yippies. Political pranksters, sometimes their political pranks had unexpected results. Abby's face met the business end of Pete Townsend's guitar when he attempted to interrupt The Who's confrontational set at 5 a.m. on Sunday morning. Roz helped found WITCH, the Women's International Terrorist Conspiracy from Hell, to fight for social change and rail against the patriarchy. She was at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, the Rankin Brigade March, anti-war rallies at the Pentagon. She was everywhere. Wherever there was a fight so hungry people could eat, Roz would be there. Roz was far enough from the stage Monday morning that she couldn't see Jimi Hendrix flash a peace sign with his hand after that first six-note run. She couldn't see his afro poofing out from the confines of his red bandana or the white fringe from his shirt dance upon the top of his crushed velvet pants, or his long flat hand, dirty fingernails and all, squashed down on his Strat's whammy bar to make the sound drop like an anvil one moment and soar like a fighter jet the next. She did hear every note singe the humid morning air. Every trill, every hammer-on, every pull-off. The guitar was not a guitar. The national anthem was not the national anthem. It was all new. She had never heard a guitar before this moment, never heard the Star-Spangled Banner before this moment. Roz fought authority. She clawed at the establishment, championed the underdog, marched for social justice, demanded change, orchestrated movements. She didn't follow leaders or watch the parking meters. The Star-Spangled Banner was the theme song of American jingoism, of blind nationalism, of football games. But not today. Never again. Now, the song was hers. Woodstock was the debut of Gypsy Sun and Rainbows, Jimmy's new thing. The Experience were no more, disbanded at the height of their powers. There was a change in the wind, and Jimmy blew along with it. He kept Mitch Mitchell on drums, but replaced Noel Redding with his old army buddy, Billy Cox. Another old friend, a Nashville cat, Larry Lee, was on guitar. And the group was rounded out by two percussion players, Jerry Velez and Juma Sultan. And Jimmy held rehearsals for the group at Michael Jeffries' rented house in Shokan, conveniently just down the road from Woodstock. A mansion made of stone with 8 bedrooms and 10 acres of land, a horse stable and a pool. And Jeffrey let Jimmy stay there, and the cook and housekeeper Jeffrey hired to keep Jimmy happy was just the cherry on top. The band got to Woodstock on Sunday and they waited. And then waited some more. And the day saw sets from Joe Cocker and Country Joe and the Fish. And the night rolled on and it was the band, Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young and Sha Na Na. Bands took the stage hours later than originally scheduled. And they hung around in the mud and rain, waiting. Drugs wearing off, waiting. Drugs kicking in, waiting. Day turned to night, waiting. The festival organizers offered Jimmy an 11 p.m. slot on Sunday night, but Michael Jeffrey refused. Jimi Hendrix was closing out Woodstock. He would be the last sound from the stage. He'd have the last say. Jeffrey could give a rat's ass what time that was. Jimmy collapsed off stage when his set was over. Slept for days. The 2-hour set was one of his longest, full of highs and lows. And when it was all said and done, Jimmy was just spent. It wasn't just Woodstock, wasn't just the hot and sweaty throngs, the mud, the drugs, the Herculean amounts of patience it took simply to endure the weekend, to wait around. It was the weight, the other kind of weight, W-E-I-G-H-T. The band had just sung about it a few hours earlier. I was feeling about half past dead, the weight of it all. One band was ending, another band was beginning. One of his managers, Chaz Chandler, out of the picture while the other, Michael Jeffrey, was making moves to assert more control. And above all, the weight of this Toronto thing, the drug bust. When he cleared his mind of all the other worries, the looming trial would pop into his brain and stress him out. What a drag. If only he could predict exactly what would happen when he walked into that courtroom in a few months. When he sat in the hot seat, looked the judge and jury in the eyes, and pleaded innocence.
We'll be right back after this
word.
Jimi Hendrix was looking for an indication that the jury had reached a verdict. Even better, they had reached a good verdict. A fair verdict. A glimmer, and when he closed his eyes and envisioned what would happen after the collective of white-shirted Canadians returned to the courtroom, it didn't involve jumping out of the frying pan and into the fire. And it most certainly involved getting out of the hot seat and walking out of the courtroom doors a free man, a vindicated man. A man who no longer had the weight of this trial clinging to his back, weighing down on him, privately consuming him. It had been hours since the jury had left to talk amongst themselves, decide the fate of the most famous rock star in the world. And Jimmy sat on a bench in the lobby outside the Toronto courtroom, decked out in a square suit, blue blazer, gray pants. His Toronto defense attorney, John O'Driscoll, sat by his side. Chaz Chandler paced back and forth like he was the bouncer for this party of two, holding their own quiet, meditative sesh on a very exclusive bench. Prison? 10 years? He'd read about a dealer bringing $250,000 of grass into Canada from Africa around the time he was arrested, and that dude just got 14 years. O'Driscoll assured Jimmy that it wouldn't go that far. Still, it wouldn't shock anyone if the 12 clean-cut male jurors wanted to make an example out of Jimi Hendrix, wilt his flower power, so to speak, give his hippy-dippy fantasies a big old dollop of normalized mainstream defiance. If they weren't 12 angry men, they were still 12 men with the power to make whatever decision they deemed fit. And the Crown Attorney had put the cops who arrested Jimmy on the stand and drove this point home. You should have seen these guys. The experience, when they got off the plane, they didn't look like anybody else. You got a plane full of normal-looking folk. They got slacks and fitted shirts and the like. And then these three moonbats pull up the rear with dashikis and sandals, beads everywhere, chewing gum like cow and its cud. And this one guy is wearing his hair all poofed out like a black man, but he's white. And if they're gonna dress like some bohemians with something to hide, we're gonna treat them the same. And they were asking for it, and the proof is in the pudding. And the guy had drugs in his bag, open and shut. Jimmy didn't deny that there were drugs in his bag when he went through customs in Toronto. He denied that they were his. And Jimmy sat on the stand, raised his right hand, solemnly swore. He recalled a girl he met in Los Angeles while on tour. She gave him something, and when he complained about a headache, he said it was Bromo Seltzer. He stuffed it into his pocket. Thanks, take it later. And he was really just being polite. Strange shit from a stranger? That was going in his pocket now and would be dealt with at a later time. And that was a problem for future Jimmy. And then he promptly forgot about it. He couldn't say where it might have ended up. It must have been the vial with the heroin packets. He just didn't look closely at it. And he was given random shit all the time. Clothes, scarves, love letters, instruments, teddy bears, hash brownies, pot, cookies, tabs, and joints and bottles. Only half the time did he actually stop to see what it was. And the defense put Sharon Lawrence on the stand to back up the story. A United Press international journalist, Sharon was at the same party and saw the girl give Jimmy something. And they put Chaz on the stand, and he explained how one of the main rules backstage was to never eat anything that was brought in by a fan. Maybe you'd enjoy some delicious cake, or maybe you'd get sick, or maybe you'd get high, poisoned, dead, or maybe you'd get arrested. And Jimmy was open and honest about drugs, more or less. His answers in the hot seat were the kinds of answers you give to the doctor when asked how many drinks a day you have, you know, on average. How often have you used cocaine? Twice, Jimmy said. How often have you dropped LSD? Four or five times. Have you smoked marijuana and hashish? Yeah. Have you ever taken heroin before? No, sir. But what about drugs? Do you still like to take drugs? I feel I have outgrown it. He had outgrown it, if it would please the court. If the judge wanted to hear him say he didn't do drugs anymore, then that's what he'd say. And the public at the time was blissfully ignorant when it came to what went on behind the closed doors of rock stars, even in the case of a wild and crazy artist like Jimi Hendrix. They saw the paisley prints in the psychedelic swirls and heard the strangeness spilling from his records. They could draw their own conclusions. The noisy suggestions in tracks like And the Gods Made Love, EXP, and If Six Were Nine were far from sober, that was for sure. But suspicions and hunches aside, how little they actually knew. Even Jimmy's arrest had been kept a secret, swept under the carpet. When Jimmy was nabbed by the Mounties at the Toronto airport, his press agent, Michael Goldstein, didn't let the story hit the wires. He wasted no time. Goldstein picked up his phone and got the Associated Press editor on the horn, played him like a fiddle, easy target. Look the other way on this Toronto thing, okay? It's all trumped up anyhow. The Mounties met the band as they walked off the plane. They never do that, and Jimmy was fucking set up, man. He'll beat it. He'll lick these charges easily and move on. No one will ever remember it happened. And here, for your troubles, I'm having a case of liquor dropped off to you. What's your favorite brand again? You're a bourbon guy, right? Should I go to your house or to the office? And the story oozed out just as Goldstein had planned. In its review of Jimmy's Maple Leaf Garden show, the Toronto Star buried a reference to his being out on bail in the middle of a sentence. And when the full account of the bust finally did make the press, it was a month later and it was in the pages of a sympathetic Rolling Stone magazine. Richie York and Ben Fong Torres didn't confirm what the drug was in their article, only what it was suspected to be. And they wrote about conservative Toronto and a very public display of humiliation by the Canadian authorities. Yet despite their solidarity, they all speculated that years of jail time was a real possibility. Jimmy's pulse went through the roof when it was announced that the jury had reached a verdict. He sat, his hands clasped together, a giant turquoise bracelet rattling against the table every time he'd wring his hands. The courtroom was full of young kids, Hendrix fans, eager to see their hero walk out a free man. Outside, wet snowflakes fell, and the 12 white shirts entered the courtroom, along with the judge, whose gaudy, powdered wig was regal overkill to the max, a long-distance salute to the motherland. It reminded Jimmy of London, of all the swinging vaudevillian-inspired fashion that was desperately missing inside this drab courtroom. And then, the verdict. Not guilty on both counts. The fans in the courtroom stood and cheered. The snowfall picked up outside. And Jimmy walked out of the courthouse, flashed a peace sign with his fingers, remembered how good a big ear-to-ear grin could feel, got on a plane to New York. A fat joint of hashish awaited him. It wasn't gonna smoke itself. Gotta keep moving. Blues falling down like hail. And on the plane back to New York, Jimmy watched an older couple play a game of cribbage across the aisle. And the weight of Toronto had been lifted, but his mind was still worried. And just because this one hurdle was clear didn't mean there weren't other hurdles left to face. Bigger hurdles, bigger problems. And he watched the couple count the crib, the cards shuffling in their hands. And he thought of tarot cards. His tarot card reading in Morocco earlier that year. A premonition come to life. He had tried to suppress it, ignore it. But that feeling came back. And that feeling that settled in and made itself known. His days were numbered. And he would die soon. He knew it. Jimi Hendrix was dreaming of Brian Jones. His dirty blonde mop top obscuring half of his face, his smile hesitant, patient, his stoned eyes swimming with kindness and with something wicked too, the duality of a rolling stone. In the dream, Brian was shouting at Jimmy, waving at him, warning him. Something didn't feel quite right. Jimmy woke up in his bed before the dream could finish. He sat straight up, gasped, and got his bearings. He was alone in his hotel room in Morocco. To be precise, on the Atlantic coast of North Africa, tapestries hung on the walls and dangled from the top of the bed. The dream felt so real, Brian felt so real, but it couldn't be. Brian had been found dead at the bottom of his swimming pool only a few weeks before. He was just 27. Jimmy and Brian were musical brothers, fashion brothers. Brian was the one who introduced Jimmy to the crowd at the Monterey Pop Festival, his first show with the experience in America. And Brian's death hit him hard. To have someone that close to him, a soul brother from another mother, gone so quickly and at such a young age. Brian had been transitioning, just like Jimmy, moving away from the Rolling Stones and looking to start something new. Some would call it a rebirth, a change. And now he was gone. In an instant, the amount of time it takes to jump into a pool, a snap of the fingers. And Jimmy rubbed his eyes, still having a hard time believing Brian was gone, still having a hard time that the Brian in his dream wasn't real. And the hanging tapestry that ran along the edge of the bed started to wave, a breeze maybe, but Jimmy had closed the window before he had fallen asleep, and the patterned fabric fluttered, waved again. It swayed dramatically, and then there was a hand on the tapestry, pulling the tapestry aside. The hand was ashen, smoky, translucent. Jimmy jumped when the hand pulled the tapestry down the length of the bed and revealed Brian Jones sitting on the corner of the bed just a few feet away from Jimmy's legs. Brian sat there, silent, smoking a cigarette, right leg crossed on top of his left leg. Chelsea boots, oversized scarf, the smoky wisps from the end of his cigarette wafted into the air, as did the rest of him. His whole body like one big haze of tobacco smoke, gray and half-formed and about to blow away. Jimmy couldn't move, couldn't speak. Brian started slowly motioning towards Jimmy, like he had in the dream, waving his arms. He wanted him to leave, to go somewhere else, to avoid something. And then, as he continued to wave his arms, he disappeared. Into thin air, just blew away. The smoky haze dissipated. The tapestry slipped back into its hanging position. And Brian Jones was gone. Jimmy had taken some friends up on a last-minute invitation to visit Morocco in the summer of 1969. So last-minute, actually, that he ditched Gypsy Sun and Rainbows as they rehearsed for Woodstock without so much as a goodbye. His friend, Deering Howe, trust fund kid and heir to the Deering's family international harvester fortune, invited him on a jaunt to North Africa. And their friends, Colette and Stella, were waiting for them. Carpe diem was Deering's bag. Sure, Jimmy thought. Why the hell not? In Morocco, Jimmy let it all hang out. He could be whoever he wanted to be. He could be himself, completely anonymous, a black American man in Africa for the first time in his life, tapping into a new yet familiar culture, new aesthetic, breathing new air on a new strip of Atlantic coastline. The most famous rock star in the world, just another nameless face on the street, driving a beat-up Chrysler through the desert, blending in with the crowds along the faded blue and white architecture. A blissful nobody. It was the only real vacation he ever took, and he needed it. He was thinking about the impending trial in Toronto, about rehearsing for Woodstock. He couldn't get Brian Jones out of his head. He walked the streets in Morocco and saw Brian's face in the vendors' faces, saw his mop-top shag bounce along ahead in the crowd. He had thought about dying lately, premonitions, feelings, and this cloud of uncertainty would envelop him out of nowhere, an unshakable feeling. His time was limited. He could feel it. He wouldn't live to be 30. He knew it. Colette, Jimmy's friend in Morocco, her grandfather was a local tribal leader and his new wife, a clairvoyant, who worked for the king. And she asked if Colette and a group of friends, Jimmy included, of course, wanted to have their cards read. She ran her hands along the lines of Jimmy's face. She wanted to see more. And she'd read him first. The group sat at a table in the Hotel des Halles. Colette offered to translate, as the clairvoyant wife only spoke French. And she wore a bright scarf, patterned shirt, beads galore. It was like a neon daydream of Jimmy's preferred fashion ideal, a kindred spirit, no doubt. And the first tarot card she drew from her deck was simple, innocuous. The Star card, a silhouetted naked woman pouring water into a stream. Very Athena-esque, or was it Aphrodite? Didn't matter, a beautiful goddess, a giant star in the sky above her, surrounded by galaxies, other worlds. The clairvoyant rattled off a sentence or two in French, and Colette laughed and nodded her head. She lightly patted Jimmy's arm as if to indicate that everything was all right so far. Then the clairvoyant flipped over the second card. It slapped onto the table, face up. The Death card, a figure on a white horse, a skeletal figure, wrapped in medieval armor, bodies at the horse's feet, the sun rising on the distant horizon. Jimmy's eyes went wide, his mouth gaping. The head of the skeleton was Brian Jones's head. Brian Jones was on the card. He was riding that medieval death horse. Brian Jones was death. And Jimmy stood up quickly from the table, gasping for air. His knees knocked against the table's leg and the cards scattered. He got himself outside. He needed air. He stood there, outside a hotel in the North African desert, and spoke softly at the warm night towards the ocean, whispering, "I'm gonna die." I'm Jake Brennan, and this is the 27 Club. The 27 Club is scored and co-written by me, Jake Brennan. Zeth Lundy is the lead writer, editor, and co-producer. The 27 Club is mixed and engineered by Sean Cahalan and Matt Bowden, both of whom lent their considerable music talent to the scoring of this series as well. Additional music and score elements by Ryan Spraker. The 27 Club is produced by myself for Double Elvis in partnership with iHeartRadio. Sources for this episode are available at doubleelvis.com on the 27 Club series page. The 27 Club is released weekly every Thursday. Season 1 features 12 episodes on Jimi Hendrix, and Season 2 will feature 12 episodes on Jim Morrison. If you like what you hear, please be sure to subscribe to The 27 Club on Apple Podcasts, the iHeartRadio app, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you'd like to win a free 27 Club poster designed by the man himself, Nate Gonzalez, then leave a review for 27 Club on Apple Podcasts or hashtag subscribe to 27 Club on social media, and we'll pick two winners each week and announce them on the Double Elvis Instagram page. That's at Double Elvis. You're going to want to give that a follow. So get out there and please spread the word about the 27 Club. As always, you can find me blabbing about other crazy rock stars on my other podcast, Disgraceland. And you can talk to me per usual on Instagram and Twitter, at DisgracelandPod. One way or another, I hope to be talking to you soon. Until then.